Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The latest craze dominating kids' attention these days is fidget spinners.
I like doing tricks with them and how fast they spin. Like, you can spin it on your nose or your finger, sometimes on your shoe. It depends on how creative you are.
But the question of whether they're a toy or a tool to help kids with attention issues made dealing with them difficult for schools this spring. We look at how schools responded. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also get the latest on state budget negotiations and other big issues before the General Assembly from political reporter James Dawson. And hear from the ACLU on the state of Delaware prisons before and after the Vaughn uprising. Plus, a sneak peek at NextFab, the big addition to Wilmington's creative district. And the latest story from Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The General Assembly started its final month of work for the year with plenty on its plate. This week alone, lawmakers were talking about abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and revising the Coastal Zone Act, just to name a few topics. But at the end of the week, it was once again the budget that moved center stage, with another somewhat dramatic development in the effort to address the state's gaping shortfall. Political reporter James Dawson is back with us this week after covering all of it this week at Legislative Hall. James, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
Well, again, another week, another twist in the budget drama. Last week it was on the spending side. This week it's kind of related to revenue. Republicans finding a reason to balk at considering the tax increase portion of Governor Carney's shared sacrifice formula. What's the stumbling block here?
I think it's simply Republicans don't want to raise the personal income tax without any new changes to prevailing wage. And that's been something that Democrats have been extremely reluctant to move on. The changes outlined in a bill that's looking for co-sponsors right now would exempt county and city governments from paying prevailing wage on public works projects for 3 years. Not the state, would not apply to the state, where a lot of that funding comes from. Mm-hmm. The GOP, in theory, already agreed to raise the corporate franchise tax, which passed the House recently, still has to go through the Senate. But a boost to the personal income tax is much harder for Republicans to swallow, and they want the D's to share their pain. So the GOP seems much less upset over making more cuts to the budget to cover this projected $65 million that would be raised through the income tax.
Republicans have put prevailing wage on the table for a number of years now, but it always seemed to be something kind of a stalking horse, a chip to be played in negotiations, but maybe not something that they were really serious about. Are they more serious this year about it?
Yeah, I think they've always been relatively serious about it, but it's just that they haven't had much more power, or rather they have much more power than they've had in a while. So Democrats need Republican votes to pass portions of the budget, not to mention any kind of tax or fee increase that they might come up with. And meanwhile, the GOP's political philosophy dovetails nicely with their current situation. So reining in spending has always been one of their core beliefs. So why not do it this year? Meanwhile, Democrats have been agonizing over these cuts, even to the point where House and Senate leadership shut down budget committee meetings, and that's something that we haven't seen before.
Now, Democrats say prevailing wage is a non-starter for them, but you indicated in your reporting this week that they have been willing to make a deal on this issue in the past. Is there much, if any, room for similar dealing this time around?
Yeah, I think there might have to be. So like you mentioned, if you look back a couple years ago, the Dems did move on prevailing wage in order to pass their five-year infrastructure plan. They agreed to raise the limit on how much a project costs before you have to pay prevailing wage on these public works projects. And that was a last-minute deal introduced after midnight on July 1st. And it's important to note here that there are other things that Republicans want, but no one that I talked to would tell me what they are specifically. So Democrats might have limited options to avoid prevailing wage changes, but who knows if these other things on the table are even harder for them to swallow that they don't want to recognize.
Having said all of that, how bad is the atmosphere in terms of the budget right now? Could we be looking at a situation where we really don't have a budget ready to vote on even on June 30th?
Yeah, it's not great. So Democrats have tried to put on a relatively positive face on these budget talks over the past couple months. And GOP has generally backed that up, saying that they think things were moving along at the time. But now that the left has tried to dig their heels in during this game of tug of war, I think Republicans are almost ready to let go of their rope to let the Democrats fall on their face. So the Joint Finance Committee leaders say they want to restart budget meetings pretty quickly to avoid a last-minute budget, but we're going to have to see if that comes to pass.
Meanwhile, other non-budget issues did move this week. Let's start with the state revising the Coastal Zone Act. What happened in that area this week?
Yeah, so that bill would open up the Coastal Zone Act for 14 pre-selected sites, most of them in Newcastle County, just one in Kent County, to try and spur redevelopment of these sites. And that means new heavy industry could move along the shorelines here. So there would be some restrictions, no new oil refineries or steel plants, but it's nowhere near as strict as current regulations are. So there was a 2.5-hour hearing Wednesday where the proposal overwhelmingly got out of committee. And really at the core issue are businesses and trade groups wanting to clean up these heavily polluted sites, spur new business, get more people here to Delaware, while environmentalist groups are trying to save something that they've held dear for nearly 50 years.
And that strength of the vote to get it out of the House committee, is that an indication that environmental groups may face more of an uphill battle to stop this legislation than maybe people initially thought?
Yeah, considering it's sponsored by a decent amount of Democrats, I'm not really seeing a path forward for environmental groups to actually block it. I mean, Republicans have been talking about doing something similar for years, and with the numbers that they have, it would only take a few D's to vote for it, especially in the Senate.
Physician-assisted suicide is on its way to the House floor now. What are the prospects there? And even if it does pass the House, will it be hard-pressed to get through the Senate by the end of this month and the end of this particular session's year?
Yeah, I'd say the bill sponsor didn't even know it would get out of committee this week. So that should tell you something. I mean, Representative Paul Bomback says he's optimistic it could pass in the full House, but he's got a few things working against him. At least two of these Democrats in committee who voted for it to be released said that they wouldn't necessarily support it on the House floor. So even if it doesn't get a vote this year, Bomback still has 2018 to make a push if he wants to.
I was going to say, it may be to his benefit to let it go until next year and maybe have a little more time to garner some support for it.
Well, it seemed to work for him in the past. I mean, 2 years ago, he introduced this, no co-sponsors. He has a handful of them now, and it got shut down pretty quickly in 2015, whereas, you know, here you had about the same amount of debate, but obviously a different result.
The abortion bill to line up Delaware's law with Roe v. Wade cleared its last hurdle in the House. But the Republicans didn't let it pass without saying their piece, did they?
No, and we had another two-hour debate on this issue with a long break in between so Republicans could redraft amendments that all eventually did fail. And it's nothing that we didn't expect. I mean, we saw the same resistance in the Senate. House Republicans tried to change the bill by keeping it illegal to perform an abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, which is in the code right now. So you had a couple other amendments, like making it so you couldn't abort a fetus if it could survive outside the womb with extraordinary medical intervention, intubation, things like that. Another would have required written consent from women before performing an abortion. But something I think that was noteworthy after the bill passed, Governor John Carney's spokesman gave a statement saying that Carney hopes lawmakers can now focus its attention on the budget. And that, frankly, angered more than a few people in his own party. And it makes me wonder how that might come back on Carney later.
He's got a lot on his plate. And one of the other things on his plate is the prison reform and the independent review that he asked for. The preliminary findings came last week. He reacted this week to those preliminary findings on that Vaughan prison uprising. Anything stand out in what the governor had to say on that issue this week?
Yeah, we have a few things. So he's trying hard to change the culture in the prison system, especially a perceived disconnect between day-to-day staff and their management. He wants to temporarily hire someone to bridge that divide. Carney also wants to buy $2 million worth of new cameras for James T. Vaughan, since the review found there were few installed in the prison, and those that were aren't modern. He wants to revamp reentry programs. But the governor was pretty blunt during the press conference. I mean, he said he's not sure if they will be successful, which is why he's ordering multiple progress reports along the line for some of these items. He also said he's disappointed that the criminal investigation is taking so long, and we still don't know when that will wrap up.
And just to kind of bring this full circle, anything he really wants to do, particularly in terms of staffing, pay, cameras, all costs money, and it goes back to what we started talking about, which is the budget. There's just no money there right now.
Right. Well, so they're renegotiating the union contract right now with the prison guards. That will run out next fiscal year. So they still have a little bit of time to work with to try and dig up some money on that side, even though prison guards say, you know, this can't wait any longer. So we'll see. He may, in fact, actually have new positions to fill at these prisons. But whether or not people come and apply for them, that's a different matter.
All very interesting. And obviously, we are likely to have even more drama next week. James Dawson, thanks so much for joining us here on The Green this week.
Thank you, Tom.
And remember, you can keep up with all of James Dawson's coverage of politics here in the First Aid online anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We have more on Delaware's prison system, talking to the director of the ACLU's National Prison Project about what they found when they took a closer look at the prisons here. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware currently has the highest rate of incarceration in the Mid-Atlantic region and nearly double the national rate between 1978 and 2015. Delaware's rate of incarceration is also nearly triple the rate of neighboring New Jersey. New York and New Jersey have shown a dramatic decline in their prison populations since the late 1990s, but Delaware's population has remained steady. A Department of Correction annual report cites close to 23,000 people are in its system as of June 30th of last year. That number includes pretrial detainees and those on probation or parole. The ACLU of Delaware hosted a discussion on prison reform earlier this week, featuring David Fonte, director of the ACLU's National Prison Project. Delaware Public Media sat down with Fonte to discuss areas of prison policy reform going on across the country and right here in Delaware.
So you've discussed how the United States incarcerates more individuals than any other country in the world and at the highest rate worldwide, and that there's a lot of variance across different U.S. states and how the policies play a role in that. Can you just touch on some different policies in states like Louisiana that have a high rate versus states like Maine with a lower rate, and how those policies are working?
There's a lot of factors that go into a state having either a high or a low rate of incarceration. A big variable is sentencing law. States that have mandatory minimum sentences, so that if you're convicted of a crime, you must be sentenced to X number of years. Obviously, that is going to, over the long term, increase the prison population. By the same token, states that don't allow prisoners to earn time off of their sentences for good behavior, that's going to also, over time, increase your prison population. It's obviously better for everyone if prisoners have an incentive to obey the rules, to go to school, to work, to behave in a positive way. And some systems allow prisoners to earn time off their sentences if they engage in those positive behaviors. Others don't, or it's only a very small amount of time you can earn off. And that, over time, is going to drive up the population. So it's usually it's a combination of variables that lead to the significant differences we have among states in their incarceration rates.
So in terms of Delaware's policy, where are some of the areas that you see the state falling short?
Well, in Delaware, it's what we call a unified system, which means that pretrial detainees, people who haven't been convicted of anything yet, but they're awaiting trial, they are also, they're in the same system as people who have been convicted. And one of the things that drives up rates of pretrial detention is cash bail. Cash bail is locking people up because they're poor. It's really that simple. Because if you have, if your bail is set at $1,000, if you can afford to pay $1,000, then you get to go home and wait for your trial at home. If you're poor and you can't afford $1,000, you go to jail. So a lot of states around the country are restricting or eliminating the use of cash bail, and that has an effect in bringing down the pretrial detained population. If the person doesn't pose a risk of violence or a serious risk of flight, there's no reason to keep someone in jail simply because they can't afford to post bail. Other what we call debtor's prison projects, locking people up, sending people to jail simply because they can't afford to pay fees or fines that have been imposed by courts. That also drives up our incarceration numbers in this country, and that's also a practice that, in addition to being unconstitutional, is just nonsensical. We jail people who don't need to be jailed. We disrupt their lives. They lose their jobs. They may lose their children. There's just no reason for it, and it needs to stop. Another variable in Delaware is that, for whatever reason, people serve longer sentences in Delaware. Whether that's a result of sentencing laws or other variables, I don't know. But we do know that people who go to prison in Delaware, on average, stay there longer than in many other states.
And going back to the cash bail, I understand New Jersey has almost eliminated that, and they've been seeing a decline in their prison population as opposed to Delaware, where it's staying steady. Is that, do you think, one of the main factors of that?
I'm not intimately familiar with New Jersey, and New Jersey has done a lot of things to bring down its prison population. But Washington, D.C., where I live, no longer uses cash bail at all. So it's certainly possible to run a court system without cash bail and to rely on other means of ensuring that people show up for their trial.
How many states, to your knowledge, have done away with the cash bail system?
I believe there are one or two, but it's also been done in other jurisdictions, like, as I said, Washington, D.C., technically not a state, but certainly a large city that functions perfectly well without using cash bail at all. And it's an area of significant interest and legislative reform going on all around the country. And in Delaware, there have been some small steps to at least reform the use of cash bail. So that's an encouraging sign.
And the staffing, understaffing was one of the key findings of this investigation, and Governor John Carney has proposed some steps to rectify that. But what, from a national perspective, what would be your recommendations to address the understaffing?
Well, the most important recommendation is just to lock up fewer people. Delaware has a very high incarceration rate. There's no reason that it needs to lock up so many people. And one way to need less prison staff is to have fewer prisoners. So that's the long-term solution. That's the permanent solution. In the interim, there need to be enough correction staff and other staff to operate the prisons in a safe and humane and constitutional manner. And it's going to be expensive, but it has to be done.
I know cameras, that was another plan, and a special assistant to kind of oversee this process. Have you seen other states implement these recommendations successfully?
Well, cameras are a positive thing because for the same reason that police cameras at least can be a positive thing, because it provides an objective record of what actually happened if there is an incident. And there's reason to believe that just the presence of the cameras has a positive effect on behavior, both by the corrections officer and by the prisoner. The knowledge that you're being recorded may make people behave in a more restrained manner. But that doesn't really get to the fundamental problem of not having enough staff. In prison, prisoners are typically not able to move around unescorted. They typically have to be watched most or all of the time, and there's good reasons for that. But it's very staff intensive, and you have to have enough staff, or every single aspect of prison operation breaks down. The health care, the visiting, security, food service, everything.
Have you seen any states that have completely reformed or at least started to reform the prison successfully and take steps in that direction?
Well, one thing California did, California significantly cut its prison population because the U.S. Supreme Court said it had to. But what that shows is that it is possible. When a system and state officials are properly motivated, they can accomplish great things. And the California prison population is much lower than it was just a few years ago. So I think that's an encouraging example that we're not talking about rocket science. We're not talking about something that's physically impossible. It has been done. It can be done.
Do you foresee a Supreme Court case based on Delaware's situation?
Well, Delaware is fortunately not yet at the point of extreme crowding that California was when the Supreme Court ruled, and let's hope that Delaware never gets to that point. It's always best if elected officials, if corrections professionals solve their own problems. But if they don't, and if human rights and health and safety and human decency are suffering, then the federal courts have to step in. And the ACLU, I think we've proven in the 90-plus years of our existence, we will not hesitate to go to court if it's necessary to preserve the lives and safety of detained and incarcerated people.
Thank you. Anything else you'd like to add about work in Delaware?
Delaware has serious problems. This recent tragic incident was really a catastrophic failure of a prison's most fundamental mission, which is to keep people safe. The only good news is that as a result of this tragedy, people are paying attention to Delaware's prison problems, and let's hope that that results in some meaningful reform and safer prisons for prisoners and staff alike.
Thanks to our Megan Pauly and David Fonte, director of the ACLU National Prison Project, for that conversation. For all of our coverage of prison reform here in the First State and the aftermath of the Vaughan prison uprising, head to our website, DelawarePublic.org. And up next, Next Fab is set to open in Wilmington's Creative District. We have a sneak peek and a look at what its arrival means to the growth of that district. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A long-awaited anchor for Wilmington's Creative District officially arrives next week. Since first unveiling the district's master plan in 2015, officials have touted NextFab, the Philadelphia-based gym for innovators, as a key piece to the puzzle. Thursday, NextFab opens in downtown Wilmington, giving the district a significant brick-and-mortar example that it's more than just murals and pocket parks. The 10,000-square-foot building at 5th and Tatnall Streets offers crafters a combination of sophisticated woodworking tools and 21st-century tech, with the goal of helping them transform their dreams into reality and maybe even launch a new business. Delaware Public Media's Larry Nagengast has followed the long path to bring NextFab to Wilmington and this week got a sneak peek at the facility. His piece on NextFab is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to tell us more about it and what it means for the Creative District.
Well, we've heard descriptions of what Wilmington's NextFab would be like. How did what you saw when you were able to visit match up with what we've heard? What can people expect when they visit NextFab?
Well, I wasn't quite sure what I would see when I walked in there on Wednesday. You know, and they haven't opened yet, so there wasn't anyone using the power saws and the routers, the laser cutters, the 3D printers. But, you know, as you enter the building, the environment is bright and welcoming, from the reception desk that was built by a NextFab member to an airy meeting room that has 7-foot skylights up above. So there's certainly a sense of anticipation. I mean, you know, what else can you say about a wood shop that doesn't have any sawdust on the floor, and you've got four 3D printers neatly aligned on a countertop waiting for the first people to use them. Overall, it's a large, clean, neat place with much more than the best in technology. There are small offices for startup businesses to use. There's a classroom. There's a wide open third floor, and there's a comfortable lounge area for relaxing during breaks or when you're finished with your project.
And just to clarify, who is NextFab's target audience? Who do they expect to show up in this space when they open next week?
Well, it's kind of interesting. In previous years, when I've talked to people about NextFab, they've tried to say, you know, this is largely for the professional, semi-professional type who's got a product ready to go to market. When I was speaking with the folks there on Wednesday, their description was a little bit broader. I mean, they say that they're open to anyone from, you know, the novice crafter, the folks who might want to build a bookcase for their home office and they don't have the tools in the basement workshop to get it done, or the pro who's got this great idea for a product and needs a place to create and test his prototypes before taking it out and seeing if there is a real market for it when he wants to sell it. They've also got agreements in place with the Delaware College for Art and Design and with Wilmington University. So you're going to see a lot of young people, college students, who are going to be spending time there, you know, as well, working on various certificates on, you know, different types of tech programs that they're involved in as well.
And this was no overnight project. It's taken some time to bring NextFab Wilmington to fruition. Can you walk us through kind of what it took to get to this point, this final point of getting the doors open on the place?
Well, as you know, the master plan for Wilmington's Creative District was made public a little bit more than 2 years ago, but the courting of NextFab really goes back to late 2013, 3.5 years ago. Carrie Gray, the managing director of the Wilmington Renaissance Corporation, at that time had learned about NextFab's operation in Philadelphia, and she took a couple of other people who were advocates for downtown development up to Philadelphia to check it out. you know, by the time the creative district plan was ready 2 years ago, it was clear that the Wilmington community wanted NextFab to be part of it. They felt that the city would benefit from having a place where makers could work on their projects and share their ideas. And what could be better than making it a hub in an area not far from Market Street that was ripe for redevelopment? NextFab, of course, is interested, but, you know, they still had to be persuaded. Then comes the end of 2015, and they get a $350,000 grant from the Delaware Economic Development Office. $350,000 can be quite persuasive in bringing someone to town. Then they had to nail down a location. And first they were looking at an old building near 8th and West Streets, and they decided that it didn't quite fit their needs. They wanted something larger. And by this time last summer, they'd settled on this 100,000 square foot property at 5th and Tatnall. They purchased the building, and since then they've been involved with renovating and installing the equipment, and now they're ready to go.
So what does NextFab's arrival mean for the Creative District? And so now it's kind of been baby steps for the district, but this is a pretty big step forward, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is significant because it is the first big deal to come to fruition. The murals and the little park and garden projects that have been completed so far have made the streetscape a lot more welcoming. But NextFab's opening means bringing new people into the neighborhood. It means more activity in the afternoon, in the evening, and on Saturdays. Now, it's going to be interesting to see how that translates and evolves. Will some of them want to live in the Willing Street Artist Village, these 12 rehab units that are nearing completion just around the corner? Will some of them create businesses and set up shop in the neighborhood? I mean, and even if they just decide to have lunch or dinner at one of the restaurants on Market Street or in the area, that's got to have some benefit to the community. And then you can't overlook the other possible collaborations here with the folks who use the mill, the booming co-working space in the Nemours building, the members of Artist Ave Station, which is a couple blocks away. Some of these people may be potential members of NextFab, or they could provide services that NextFab members could use if they start growing their own businesses.
And your piece suggests there may be more on the way soon in the Creative District. What are officials saying could be next in the Creative District?
Other enterprises. There's a film and video production business, for example, that's considering moving into the Creative District. Carrie Gray at Wilmington Renaissance isn't tipping her hand other than to say that we can expect more announcements in the coming year. Now, if you head down Tatnall Street, if you work your way down from the mill in the Nemours building, down the 6 blocks or so to NextFab, you'll see a mix of established buildings, businesses, and vacant storefronts. Now, if a couple of entrepreneurs can fill in those vacant spots and then develop synergies with the businesses that are already there, the neighborhood's turnaround could easily accelerate. Now, that's not going to happen in the next couple of months, but there's certainly room for some optimism here.
I guess that's kind of really what the big hope for NextFab is that its influence won't be limited just to the Creative District. As you mentioned a little bit earlier, there are like-minded collaborative spaces, both in the craft arena and beyond, that are also trying to tap into the same kind of collaborative energy in downtown Wilmington.
Well, absolutely. I mean, as we've mentioned, there's Artist Ave Station. The mill isn't the only co-working space around. You've got Started Up Delaware on Market Street. You've got 1313 Innovation in the Hercules Plaza. We've got some creative marketing businesses like Carvertides. We've got some startups in the fintech area, especially in the mill. On top of that, you've got some successful businesses like the Archer Group and Trellist down in the Loma District at the south end of Market Street. I mean, no one has a real clear picture of where all of this would lead, but generally, this is a pretty good time to be part of the creative community in Wilmington.
So if anyone's interested in getting involved in NextFab, how do they do that? What is available there for people? I guess there is kind of a range of how you can use this space.
Absolutely. I mean, NextFab has a wood shop. It's got a metalworking shop. It's got 3D printers. It's got laser cutters. It's got something called a Wazer, which is a desktop water jet cutter that'll work on just about anything except for tempered glass. So it's going to have classes. It's going to offer advice for budding entrepreneurs. It will have community events. It's supposed to be a place where crafters of all skill levels can work on their projects and share ideas with others. So it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves. They've had success at two locations in Philadelphia. There's good reason to think that they should be able to do the same in Wilmington. Don't want to make it a commercial, whatever, but if you want the details, just go to nextfab.com and check it out and see what's there for you.
Any indication from the NextFab people about just initial interest from people who've already heard about it, even though the place hasn't opened yet?
The interest has been pretty good. The folks in the Barrel of Makers community, Maker Project, a lot of them are already members because the NextFab memberships are usable at all locations. So people in Wilmington can go to the Philadelphia sites, and even if you join in Wilmington, that means you can go up to Philly and use the facilities up there. So the interest seems to be pretty good. They tell me they've got about 700 members overall. That includes Philadelphia. So, there's a decent base there. Then there's, certainly are people in Wilmington who are interested. And you're going to see people in Philly coming down here too, because one of the interesting things about NextFab is that each of their three sites, at each one, they try to have something that's not at the other places, and in Wilmington's case, it is this water jet laser cutter. So that's something that people in Philadelphia who might be interested in that particular tool may very well come down here to check it out the same way as some folks in Wilmington will be going up to NextFab in Philly to take use of some of the tools and equipment that's there that they don't have in Wilmington. So you're going to have that mix as well.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. Larry's piece previewing NextFab's Wilmington launch next week is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in just a moment with the latest piece from Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We turn now to another piece from Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative, our partnership with four other public radio organizations, WYPR in Baltimore, Virginia Public Radio, Delmarva Public Radio at Salisbury University, and WESM at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. The collaboration produces reports examining a broad spectrum of issues affecting the Chesapeake Bay and its watershed. In 2009, President Obama signed an executive order recognizing the Chesapeake Bay as a national treasure. That began a federal-state partnership to restore and protect it, including a plan to revive the wild oyster population through sanctuaries in Maryland and Virginia. Oysters are big money, and they help clean the bay. But President Trump's budget proposal would pull federal funding for those sanctuaries. Pamela D'Angelo reports for Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative.
Restoring some of the wild oyster reefs gutted by a century of overfishing, disease, and pollution is not without hurdles. An initial plan to restore 20 tributaries by 2025 was scaled back to 10. And there is a shortage of shell needed by baby oysters to latch onto. Lewis Sneed, Baltimore U.S. Army Corps of Engineers project manager, ran out of shell last month for the Tredavon River project. And it's not the first time.
We were contacted by a contractor to tell us they've run out of shell. We don't know why there wasn't enough shell. We've gotten as much as we can get for now until they can accumulate more.
Tredavon is just south of the bay's largest restoration project, Harris Creek. At 350 acres, Harris was completed 2 years ago using granite, shells, and other materials. But watermen and boaters expressed concerns about stone in Tredavon. That delayed the project for months, so $1 million in federal funding was quickly transferred to Virginia.
What you'll be seeing them do is effectively picking up the stone with an orange peel bucket on a big crane and lowering it under the water, releasing it.
Out on Virginia's Piankatank River, Army Corps' Norfolk District has partnered with the Nature Conservancy and Virginia Marine Resources Commission. They're using the extra $1 million toward building a 25-acre sanctuary reef here. And for the first time, Virginia, which also has a shell shortage, is using large granite blocks instead of shell. Andrew Button is Virginia's oyster replenishment chief.
If you put any kind of substrate down on the bottom at the right time of year, and this is the perfect time of year to be doing this project, by this time next year, all this granite should be covered in living oysters.
Each sanctuary is carefully studied to ensure oysters will live and reproduce. Susan Connor with Norfolk District's Army Corps says so far, both Maryland and Virginia projects are looking good.
Both Baltimore District and Norfolk District and our state partners have monitored the oyster reefs that we've been building for about 10 years, and they're really showing healthy oyster populations.
But the two states are facing their biggest hurdle, President Trump's budget for next year. It has zeroed out federal funding to support sanctuaries in four more tributaries and for in-depth scientific reporting that begins when the oysters reach their prime at 3 years old. The Nature Conservancy is asking Congress to restore federal funding to previous levels of $5 million. TNC's Andy Lacatelle says money is still needed for Piankatank.
We think we still have a pretty long way to go to get to at least a minimally restored functional oyster network here in the Piankatank. So it's going to take significant funding. It's going to take support from our state General Assembly. It's going to take support from our congressional representatives to continue to fund oyster restoration in the Bay.
For now, the shortage for finishing the Tredevon project isn't about money, it's about shell. At least until September, when Congress finishes the work on the federal budget. I'm Pamela D'Angelo for Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative.
Thanks, Pamela. And a reminder that Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative, is funded by the participating stations with grant support from the Clayton Baker Trust, the Bancroft Foundation, Michael and Ann Hankin, the Jim and Patty Rouse Foundation, the Rob and Elizabeth Tyler Foundation, and the Midshore Community Foundation. And the Green continues momentarily with Enlighten Me and a look at how schools have responded to the latest craze, fidget spinners. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. If you're a parent or teacher, you're probably very aware of the latest fad, fidget spinners. Haven't heard of them? Well, they're a small gadget you can spin between two fingers, then try to balance on one finger or do other tricks. As they spin, you can hear a faint whirring noise. They've grown in popularity at a dizzying rate, catching Delaware schools a bit flat-footed in deciding how to handle them. And complicating the issue was the claim by companies producing them that they are more than toys, that they're a therapeutic tool that can help kids with attention problems. For this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pike has hit the road to see how some first aid schools responded to the fidget spinner fad.
It started with just one or two. Then this noise seemed to be heard all over Delaware elementary schools. Some teachers say fidget spinners seemed to pop up in their classrooms in March or April, but they exploded in May. If one student saw a friend had one, they had to have one too.
I like doing tricks with them and how fast they spin. Like, you can spin it on your nose or your finger, sometimes on your shoe. It depends on how creative you are.
Ahmad Smith is a fifth grader at Southern Elementary in Newcastle. He's had a plain black fidget spinner since April. But shortly after he bought it, he couldn't bring it to school anymore. A few weeks ago, Southern Elementary Principal Jeff Jabot sent out a video announcement to parents asking fidget spinners be left at home.
So students, if you would like to have a spinner or you own a spinner, very cool toys to play with, but play with them at home. So you can imagine how they are starting to distract our classrooms. Simply, if you're sitting next to somebody who is spinning this and balancing on their finger and dropping it on their desk, you know, it's very difficult to learn when that's happening next to you and very difficult to teach when your students are doing that.
Jabot says he was trying to be proactive and deal with the spinners before they became a bigger issue.
So I didn't see a whole lot of students walking and spinning them on their fingers, but I did see them start to seep out of recess time and into the cafeteria, where I would come into classrooms and I would see them sitting on the desks.
It's a decision that disappointed Ahmad Smith, but he says he understands why teachers wouldn't want them in the classroom.
I wouldn't say I was angry, but I was pretty upset that, like, I couldn't play with it during class. But I do know that it would really, like, distract her if people would, like, drop it on the floor, drop it on their desk, make a big sound and hard for other people to learn that don't have any.
Educators at Middletown's Bunker Hill Elementary weren't too thrilled with the spinners either. Principal Edmund Gerto also made a school-wide announcement for students to leave them at home.
If there are things that are distracting kids from their learning, you know, it's something we have to address.
But the decision to ban spinners was a bit more complicated than exiling other toys and games that find their way to school. That's because fidget spinners have been marketed as a tool to help calm people with ADHD or anxiety. And schools allow tools that calm kids down in the classroom, like stress balls, when defined by therapists as a fidget tool. A basket of stress balls sat in Holly Schwalbe's classroom at Bunker Hill when I visited her recently. Schwalbe is a third-grade special education teacher. She says the explosion in the spinner's popularity created a dilemma. Could they still be deemed a fidget tool?
The fidget spinner has become such a fad and such a popular toy that it's replaced it as a tool. And in the classroom, we need tools for them to be successful and not toys.
Other schools, like Philip C. Schall Elementary in Selbyville, also treated spinners as a toy. But instead of banning them, they sought a middle ground. Students there could have them at recess, but not in the classroom. Principal Karen Clausen says fidget spinners are not enough of a problem to ask students to leave them at home, yet.
It's recess time. You know, if the other students are distracted by the fidget spinner, that's okay, because everyone's running around, everyone's playing. It's not going to cause any instructional distraction for the student as well. So at that point in time, as long as it's not creating a discipline issue during recess, I don't have any problem with them using it during recess time.
But at Mount Pleasant Elementary in North Wilmington, one teacher was not only willing to keep spinners in her classroom, she found educational value in them. Fourth grade teacher Jackie Chesworth says one of her students suggested making them with a 3D printer after seeing her cousin do it. And Chesworth and her class turned it into a project, selling the spinners they made to raise money for students who couldn't pay for field trips. In the process, they researched spinners, their various designs, and their purpose to help make and market their product. We visited Ms. Chesworth's classroom while three of her students were assembling the fidget spinners they made with 3D printers.
Well, let's just make them. We can't.
It's already printing.
Well, how long is
it? It's 3D printing.
I only have a handful of kids that even take them out anymore. And I think because they get to use them so much, like on the off time, and they put them together, they design them, and they realize the purpose of it, they just are not as interested in actually using them themselves in the classroom setting if they don't need it.
But Chesworth still has rules about using spinners in her class. They can stay if used appropriately.
When kids are using it to focus, they'll have it in their pockets, or they'll be reading and you can see them using it in the other hand. Now when kids are using it just to play, like they're trying to balance it on their nose or pass it to somebody without it dropping. And that's when it goes on my desk and they just pick it up at the end of the day.
Isabel Salvatore, one of Chesworth's students, says she thinks those rules are fair.
Quiet time, we can take it out and just like spin it all we want, but we can't make that loud of a noise really with it. And that's how most of the kids get caught with their fidget spinners. There's been like 5 fidget spinners taken away. Chesworth is selling one of them, I think.
Chesworth says being able to use the popularity of fidget spinners for a project that completely engaged her students was a dream scenario. How well did it work? Consider what Brianna McGee, the student whose idea got the project rolling, said when she was asked, what's more fun, playing with a fidget spinner or making one?
Making a fidget spinner, because after you get to play with it as well.
And as schools let out for the summer across the first state, students can spend as much time playing with their spinners as they please. Meanwhile, teachers get a break from the whirring noise that has sparked debate in schools across the country. And who knows, that break, unlike summer vacation, could be permanent. Like other fads that seemed to disappear as quickly as they arrived, fidget spinners could join the ranks of Beanie Babies and Silly Bands by fall.
With my experience with trends, both as a kid and as a dad and as an educator, this is probably going to be somewhat short-lived.
But Southern Elementary Principal Jeff Jabot adds he suspects it's not the last issue like this schools will face.
And I think the life of this will be, what will the next thing be? And what will the next trend be that's easy to bring to school?
Or maybe that whirring noise will have a longer lifespan than expected. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie, for enlightening us this week. And that's all for The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like your feedback. Tell us what you think about today's stories or your story ideas on our Facebook page
on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Pamela D'Angelo from Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative, Delaware Public Media's James Dawson, Megan Pauly, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the Delaware Public Media staff, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.